This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
A very good morning and welcome to the bite-sized business breakfast. It is the first day of the holy month of Ramadan, 11th of March, Monday morning, Ramadan Mubarak. What have we got for you today? Well, anything but a slow news day. Let's kick off with the news out of Saudi Arabia over the weekend. Two for the price of one. GDP data from Saudi Arabia, the economy contracted. Aramco, profits falling. Sounds bad. It's much more nuanced than that. So we'll get details and analysis from the CEO of Saudi Aramco, Amin Nasser, and Dan Richards, the economist. What else can I tell you? We had a big focus today on a story that broke last week and we've been getting so many questions on. So we've had a couple of experts in to talk about it. And this is the new ombudsman for banking. Basically, if your bank messes up, you've now got someone to go and complain to. So Brandy's been speaking to, number one, a lawyer, Alfred Thornton at Clyde & Co, and Jamal Saleh, Director General of the UAE Banks Federation. Lots of detail on that. What else can I tell you? Fake listings here in Dubai in terms of real estate. Big crackdown by the authorities, RERA, Dubai Land Department, particularly on portals. Well, one of the biggest portals is, of course, Beirut. We've been in conversation with the CEO, Haider Ali Khan. He says they've taken down a bunch of listings already and more to come on Wednesday. Great interview with Haider coming up on the podcast. And finally, CEOs here in the UAE really bullish about the year ahead. They think revenue's going to grow at their companies, and they think they're going to get bigger bonuses. Happy days. Who wouldn't want to be in the C-suite? The thoughts of Jack Cabaz of Cooper Fitch, the recruitment firm who put the research together. All that to come. First up, though, let's jump into those top stories.
Turning our attention to facts and figures this morning, a little less exciting than Ryan Gosling in a pink suit, we have Saudi Arabia's full-year GDP numbers. Rock and roll. We have the country's economy for the full year, the GDP falling by just under 1%, 0.8 of 1%. That is largely on the back of voluntary lower oil production. Dan Richards of Emirates NBD has been telling us this morning.
Saudi Arabia's GDP shrank by 0.8% last year. On the face of it, of course, a contraction in a country's economy isn't always the most positive story, but I think Saudi Arabia is something of an exception to that story, you could argue, as it's kind of a self-imposed contraction, as it was really the voluntary oil production curves that drove that slowdown or that contraction in the economy, and we saw oil GDP shrink by 9%. By contrast, the non-oil sectors performed very well, expanding by 4.4% last year. And I think given the pressures we saw in terms of global slowdown and still resilient inflation and higher interest rates, that is a pretty robust growth rate.
But given that Saudi has extended those voluntary oil cuts, that's a million barrels a day for them, into Q2, what does that mean for Emirates NBD's prediction for the economy this year? And what does it mean for Saudi's ability to fund all its giga projects?
So looking ahead to this year, we expect it will be a fairly similar story as last year, given that those additional oil production curves have been extended into the second quarter. So our headline GDP growth forecast for this year is for growth, but at 0.7%, not particularly robust. And we're seeing a 4%, or we're forecasting a 4% contraction in the oil sector, offset basically by 4% growth again in the non-oil sector. I think when you look at the PMI surveys over the start of the year, that would support that outlook for still pretty resilient non-oil sector growth. In terms of what is driving that, we'd expect government spending and investment, especially into mega projects, continue driving growth despite lower income expected this year.
Dan Richards, Senior Economist at Emirates NBD. Now, as well as the GDP numbers for Saudi, you could argue, we got a second set of GDP numbers for Saudi in the frame of the Saudi Aramco results. I mean, you could argue, and it has been for years, although changing, diversifying, that Saudi Aramco is the kingdom.
Yes, in many ways it is. So the numbers were 25% reduction in profit for Aramco, still coming in at $121 billion, by far the world's biggest oil company. Here's the CEO, Amin Nasser, speaking about what happened in terms of the numbers, his overview, his summary.
It is clear that the world has a growing need for affordable, reliable, and lower carbon energy. As a global oil demand reached a record high in 2023, we continued to implement the largest capital program in our company's history. This project will help us maintain our maximum sustainable capacity at 12 million barrels per day, as directed by the government. And they support our unique ability to rapidly respond to changes in the market.
Amin Nasser, he's the CEO of Aramco.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
One of the big financial stories of the quarter, and that is the setting up here in the UAE of a new financial services ombudsman to handle complaints from the public, me and thee, against banks and insurance companies. We are joined now by a lawyer to look at that side of it and look at it from the customer side. Alfred Thornton is a partner at Clyde & Co. He joins us on the line this morning. Morning, Alfred.
Good morning, Brandy.
Lovely to speak to you. Let's kick off by doing a bit of a 101. Why is the UAE putting this in place?
Well, Brandy, it's part of a big change to financial services regulation generally in the UAE. So there's been a movement away from separate regulators to a, let's call it a consolidated regulator under the central bank. The central bank has been looking at its mandate covering licensed financial institutions, sort of banks and the traditional financial institutions, and then insurance companies have also come in among into their remit. And as part of that, they've identified particularly for individual people who are customers, that there is a need for a new way of assisting people with their complaints and issues they may have with insurance companies. And that is where this new regulation all comes, stems out of and comes from.
So what's it going to do for me?
Well, hopefully quite a lot. Hopefully it's going to make it very easy for you to, if you do have an issue, either with a licensed financial institution, be that a financial services provider, be that an insurance company, that you can far easier than you were able to in the past come to a conclusion if you have a dispute, for argument's sake. It's hopefully also going to let you become more aware of your rights. So what you can do, what rights you have if you have a dispute, say, about an insurance claim on your motor car or your house got flooded over the weekend and you feel that the claim is not being addressed in the correct way.
Now, I understand that it's not just individuals that can use Sanidec, for that is the new ombudsman, but also SMEs. Why have they included companies in this, and what actually counts as an SME for this purpose?
I think the whole purpose of an ombuds unit is very much to assist people who perhaps don't have the same legal strength that a bank or an insurance company may have. So SMEs would fall into that category. How the UAE has looked at it is they have categorized SMEs based on the sector in which that business operates and then also its size. So broadly, there have been two sectors identified, that is retail and manufacturing. It remains to be seen how everybody fits into those two. And there they have two sort of threshold levels. If you are in retail, if you employ less than 200 employees, or your annual turnover is less than 200 million dirhams, then you would be regarded as an SME. If you are in manufacturing and you employ less than 250 employees and have a turnover of less than 250 million dirhams, then you would be an SME.
Right, and then you can use the ombuds unit, as you have called it this morning, in order to get your disputes resolved.
Correct, and it's a very simple process. They've gone live last Thursday. They have an app, so Sanidec app, which you can download. You can go onto their website. Once you've had some feedback from your financial services provider in writing, you can then make a complaint on the app. And it's a very, very abbreviated and quick process, very different to the court process or, for example, the insurance disputes committee's process that previously existed with insurance disputes.
What do we know about the level of disputes that we see through the old system, the bank and then the central bank, if it's escalated at the moment? How high is that?
Well, I would say financial services disputes are probably a big part of where there is disagreement. And my background is largely in insurance, and you can see that in the past, you know, insurance is a massive industry, and a lot of these things are small claims. So, you know, motor cars and homes, and those are things you don't want to clutter up the court's time with. Those are things where, as an individual, and I have a ding in the back of my car and I disagree with my insurer as to how it should be dealt with. Those are things you really don't want to go to court to deal with. So I think that is something which is the sea change here, is we're talking about those things where there's this imbalance in power, if I can call it that way, between the consumer and the bank, where this is going to fundamentally change things for us as consumers. It's really the whole background to SANADAC, which is the ombudsman unit, is consumer protection and consumer assistance.
How much power, though, is SANADAC going to have to get an insurance company to pay out, for example?
Well, in the end of the day, you remember it's been set up by the regulator. And so onshore, so outside of the financial free zones, every bank, every licensed financial institution, so that's, you know, Islamic Sharia compliant financial institutions, every insurance company is regulated. So firstly, there's the regulatory pressure. But this also is going to form part of effectively the court's process. So as a bank, I am going to, or a insurance company, I don't have a choice as to how this process is going to pan out when it is an individual like me who has a complaint about my motor insurance or my house that was flooded, my property policy. So it is going to be fundamental.
So they can force an insurance company, to use your flood example, to pay out for damage?
Well, they'll intermediate, give a decision. So they are trying to educate everybody about how they see the position. You can take it on appeal, and there's various stages. So if the bank or the insurance company was unhappy with the decision, there is an appeals process. But ultimately, if that is not appealed, that decision becomes one that will be binding.
What are we still waiting to know? As you say, this went live towards the end of last week. It's early days. Do you yourself still have questions that you want answers to?
Of course, many, as you would expect with something new. I mean, SANADAC has had a big launch. It's trying very hard to educate people, but there are differences. So, I mean, you would know in the UAE, for example, you have individuals who may, let's say, have a property insurance policy over a big asset. They probably correctly wouldn't fall into the SME category just because of their size. And so I think understanding where that split is, understanding that certain types of, using insurance as an example, claims may not be, even owned by an SME, may not actually be a simple claim, that is something which isn't quite clear how it'll work out. Because, you know, on a big complicated dispute, it may not be appropriate to go via an ombudsman unit in the first instance. So that's an example. I think, for example, the gap between what is financial and what is banking and what is insurance. So in the middle, you'll be well aware of financial advisors selling all manner of insurance investment products. Which category does it fall in? Remains to be seen.
We have to leave it there, unfortunately. Alfred Thornton, partner at Clyde & Co, talking us through the new ombudsman this morning.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Size Business Breakfast.
Well, we're looking this morning at one of the biggest financial stories of the month, if not the quarter. Big change for the way the financial services industry operates when it comes to complaints, because the UAE now has a financial services ombudsman. We are joined by Jamal Saleh now, who's the Director General of the UAE Banking Federation. Jamal, good morning. It's lovely to speak to you.
Good morning, Beth.
What is SANADAC going to mean for the financial services industry itself? How is it going to change things?
It's a monumental change. This will set the UAE one more step into the pioneering status that it gives evolving. This is the first ombudsman in the MENA region, the first financial ombudsman in the MENA region. It's going to work with full impartiality, effectiveness, and so forth, which means that we will be able to standardize things much better than before.
What do you mean by standardize? Give me some examples.
If anyone has any complaint, there's a place that they can go to, file a complaint. There's a process to be followed within a number of days. the complaint needs to be looked into, a reply needs to be given, there's a turnaround time, an SLA, and so forth. So it will be running in a standardized way.
Right, so the service level that you get won't depend on whichever bank or insurance company you're using in their own internal processes and how good they might or might not be.
Exactly.
So what kind of complaints do you expect to feature most strongly? What makes up the biggest sector of banking complaints at the moment?
The complaints that are to be accepted are the ones that will involve some sort of deception, mis-selling, malpractice, and so forth. Presently, most of the complaints have to do with the calculation of charges, not being aware of something that was applied later, and so forth. So now, with the new entity, everything will be clear, and everything will be run, as you said, uniformly across all the members.
What kind of level of complaints does the sector see at the moment? What does that look like?
The number of complaints has been coming down because all banks have established a complaint management unit at their end. You do get a lot of complaints lodged at the bank or at the previous unit, but a big part of them are not really complaints. They were more of dissatisfaction of a service. As I said, a complaint would have to be something that has led to a loss or a missed opportunity. And that's why the number itself is a little exaggerated, because it's a mix between actual complaints and a dissatisfaction of a service, which is not a complaint.
Right. So the bank's actually doing something wrong then. What will it mean for the banks and the insurance companies themselves in terms of the cost of doing business if they're not handling this anymore?
I don't think anything will change for the banks apart from, as I said, standardizing the process and making sure that people who do have a valid complaint do receive an impartial entity to look into the case. But I honestly don't see an actual effect on the banks and the business and the doing business for the banks per se.
What does it mean for the length of time of the complaint process? What do we normally see at the moment when complaints go through the bank and then might be escalated, and what could happen to it?
As I said, now everything will be standardized, meaning that a complaint filed, there's a 30-day window that it has to be looked into and replied to the person. Currently, the process varies. If a bank can look into a case fast enough or will need some time, but under the ombudsman, under SANADAC, it will have to be within the approved SLAs and turnaround times. So it's a 30-day window for all.
And how transparent is the process going to be under SANADAC? How much would I be able to find out about the outcome of my complaint, for example?
This is one of the first three words. When we said SANADAC will be impartial, efficient, and transparent. So there will be full transparency from SANADAC in total, as well as for each complaint, what the person lodging a complaint will be able to get. I'm honestly sure that having this unit now in this fashion will elevate our standard further. One thing I should actually tell you, if you remember last year I was with you, we talked about the trust index of the UAE, which at that time we were country number two, and we scored 84%. We have just received the latest trust report, where we have become country number one with a 90% score. We need to maintain this. We need to maintain it and maybe even improve it. One of the best ways to do that is to have an ombudsman, is to have a SANADAC, to make sure that any genuine complaint is looked into and resolved amicably between the two parties.
Remind me, Jamal, who puts out that trust report? Who's verifying that ranking?
It's a European company that does it for some 60 countries, I believe, standardized year after year. and countries participate in it. The number changes annually, so it's sometimes a country might come in, a country might come out, but it's global, and they use the same questions with the same sample size, etc., and they don't change it from year to year, and then they inform you of your ranking.
Just before we let you go, could further down the line a knock-on effect of this actually even be higher ratings for banks and the UAE as a whole, the cumulative effect of that growing trust?
I think this will have a greater impact on the country in total, the image of the country, the ranking of the country. We want the UAE to be in the realm of the highest, the best, the top. And we want our central bank to be ranked among the best. Of course, you know, a lot of work was done, as you know, but by our central bank. So the image of the UAE and the ranking of the UAE will definitely be looked better at. For banks per se, it might make some difference, but not as much as the total sector in totality.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning. Jamal Saleh is Director General of the UAE Banking Federation, speaking to us about the new ombudsman, SANADAC, that has been set up to cover not just banks, but insurance companies as well.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Size Business Breakfast.
Right then, let's talk about the intersection of two of the most exciting industries in the UAE at the moment. They are real estate and technology. Who better to speak to than the CEO of Bayut & De Bezel, Haider Ali Khan, with us in the studio. Heidi, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, guys. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks very much indeed. And really good to have you here, because one of the big talking points over the past couple of weeks has been RERA and the Land Department and their directives on listings of property here in the UAE. Let me just recap what happened. About 2 weeks ago, two, 3 weeks ago, mid-February, RERA and the Land Department issued this on X. They said all real estate offices must update the digital real estate platforms portals within 3 working days, which should result in removing all unavailable properties for rental or sales. And they went on to say, through our scheduled inspections of electronic real estate portals, we noticed that there are some properties that are no longer available for sale or rent and are still displayed on the portals by real estate agents. And they finished by saying, we ask everyone to abide by the instructions. And in the event of a violation, they finished with, a fine will be applied in particular. That was about 2.5-3 weeks ago, Haider. Of course, Bayut, one of the big listings portals here. Why was this action necessary by RERA?
I think we've all kind of lived through this over the years. You know, when you're going and looking for a property, you see something online and then you make a call and you're told that's not available, let me show you something else. And I think if you look at some of the more advanced markets, look at the West, you won't run into this issue too much. And rightfully so. You know, things that should be advertised or that are advertised should be available. And I think we've also kind of held that for the longest, which is don't show people one thing and then when they inquire about it, go and show them something else. It leads to frustration for consumers.
But how do you police this? Because, for example, if I set up a real estate agency tomorrow, Dickie's Deals, let's call it, and I become a client of Bayut or one of the other portals,
sure,
and I say, right, I've got these properties and I've got a, I don't know, apartment in the downtown area and it's 3 million dirhams. How do you know that Dickie's Deals are throwing straight dice? Is it down to you and the other portals to monitor this, to police Dickie's Deals and others?
Sure. So, look, I think these things have been around. The forums, which RERA has, have been around for a while. And now we're just working a lot with the Land Department and integrating our platforms with the Land Department. So if you are a real estate agent, you will get access to a property. You talk to a landlord and you want to advertise it. You'll have to fill out a form. Once that form is filled, that information is available with RERA. And once you advertise that property on Bayut, we can actually ping DLD and get the permit number back and make sure that that property is an actual authentic property, which has been approved by the landlord. The landlord has approved the advertisement by the real estate agent, by that specific real estate agent for that property. So we can actually look into that kind of information now.
Okay, so let's talk numbers. How many listings did you take down as Bayut as a result of this, would you say?
Yeah, so we've been, so listings have come down quite a bit. I would say around at this point, and I've been checking on a regular basis, we have about, oh, it's about 30% of the content in Dubai has come down. And it continues to come down. We have issued very clear guidance around this to real estate agents. And on Wednesday, we will take down more listings. So we've given them an opportunity to actually go and fix these permits. They're fairly straightforward to fix. But we are, as I said, we're working very closely with the land department, pinging them constantly to make sure that these properties are authentic.
So are you saying that 30% of the content on your site has come down?
Yes, correct.
And when you bring more down or you tell people to take it down, what further percentage drop do you think we'll see?
So I think we're probably looking at another 10% that we will take down in 2 days' time. Yep.
So in terms of the fines that DLD and RERA were talking about, what do we know about how many fines have been handed out, either to portals like yourselves or to the brokers who post the listings?
Yeah, you know, we've partnered very closely with DLD on this, and we will make sure we're going to lead. I mean, we are leading the way. We have been making it very clear to agents to go and fix this behavior. This fine is for people who wrongly advertise properties. Now, as a portal, you can imagine where you have hundreds of thousands of properties, it's very difficult to control every piece of content. You know, there are changes that are happening literally every instant. But we are, as the integration gets tighter and tighter, we have a much closer check on it. So these fines are really being issued to real estate agencies who are wrongly advertising properties.
How do you spot the stuff that is wrong?
As I said, so when the agent advertises, loads up the details of the property, they have to specify a permit number. And then that permit number allows us to pull that same information from the land department and match that with what the agent has specified.
What does it mean for you as a business, because you are a business,
sure,
if 40% and another 10%, so if you take down 40% of your listings, I mean, are you not losing revenue from that?
Certainly it impacts those things, right? But at the end of the day, the key thing is we're not losing leads. The people who are looking, that number actually has gone up last week. And I personally believe that, you know, we will lead the way in this, which is we are going to be the first clean portal in Dubai. That's fine. And, you know, it's part of business. It has to evolve. It has to be a cleaner market.
But what is the hit to your bottom line here?
Nothing yet.
So let's talk about some of the other issues. I was looking on when I was going through the DLD and the RERA X feed over the past 3 weeks ago to find that data about portals and listings. Saw a picture of you and Mohan Bingalita smiling at me, signing a deal. I thought, oh, here we go. That's Haider. He's coming into the studio today.
Yeah,
it's not to do with listings, is it? What deal have you done with RERA?
So we've signed an MOU with DLD where if you are an Emirati and, you know, we have this effort going across the country where you're trying to get more of the Emiratis into the workforce. So if you're an Emirati who's a real estate agent, we will support you in getting a business started. We will give you a package on Bayouth and Dubizzle where you can come and advertise your properties for the first year for free of cost.
And this is particularly for Emiratis?
Yes, correct. So Emiratis, Emirati-owned agencies, please come on board. As the country is trying to get more of the Emirati population into the workforce.
Final question before we let you go. Artificial intelligence, so much buzz and hype about it at the moment here in the UAE as elsewhere. Is it moving the needle for you?
You know, we launched Bayouth GPT, it's been a few months now, and we're planning to open it up to more of an audience. Right now it's behind a login wall, but we get about over 500 users every day who are using it, and I really feel like for the first time, we're getting to understand our users a lot better, because we are understanding queries now as opposed to just a bunch of filters.
When you say your users, are you talking about the brokers or the people
like
me who browse?
No, the consumers. What are they looking for? It's fascinating. You bring six people in a room and you ask them, okay, you kind of ask this, you know, you need to ask the same question. They will all write it differently because they all come with different perspectives. And that's pretty eye-opening. And I think that's very, very exciting for us.
Haider, always good speaking to you. Appreciate your time this morning. We've run out of time. Haven't got time to ask you about the IPO question, but I have asked you about seven times before. So we'll let that one lie for now. I'm sure when you've got something to say, you'll come back and speak to us. But for now, Haider Ali Khan is the CEO of Divisl. Appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you so much.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Where we're talking growth on the Business Breakfast this morning, delighted to be joined in the studio by Jack Cabas, Managing Partner and Head of the CEO Practice at Cooper Fitch. Morning, Jack.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Right, your new report has just dropped and it's a good news story because more than half of CEOs expect their bonuses to increase this year compared to the previous period, and that's on the back of strong revenue growth. The impression I took was that this was an overwhelmingly positive report. What's your view?
Yeah, absolutely. A completely positive, optimistic views, and well-deserved. Markets have been growing in the region, particularly in the UAE. There's been strong commercialization gains across all businesses, various industries, and it's reflective of the market and the growth of those organizations and the leadership.
Okay, well, let's unpick this then. Revenue growth. And you look in particular at the UAE and Saudi Arabia. Strong in both. I was surprised to see that most of the CEOs you spoke to think that UAE is going to be a stronger source of revenue growth this year than Saudi Arabia.
Good point. I think the key there is Saudi has a wider range of organizations in different business cycles. There's heavy investment, a lot of scale-up, start-up, operational setup compared to the UAE, where there are a high proportion of established businesses maturing and growing year on year. And the Saudi economy, there's a mixture of organizations in their life cycle. And I think that'll change over the next 3 to 5 years. Many of the organizations are still transforming, still setting up, and still being invested in significantly, where the real results haven't been aren't tangible yet.
So Saudi Arabia's not jam tomorrow, but jam in 2 or 3 years' time?
Absolutely.
Okay, let's take a step back and look at who you spoke to. It's a CEO survey, speaking to local regional CEOs. Paint a picture of your sample.
So we would have surveyed just under 100 CEOs from a variety of industries: FMCG, telecommunications, real estate, investment management, banking and financial services, telecommunications, and family groups, of course, as they are quite significant in the region.
Right. And in what geographies were they?
UAE and Saudi Arabia.
Within the UAE, would that mainly be Dubai?
Both Abu Dhabi and Dubai, a fair split.
Let's talk about diversity and inclusion. It's one of the sectors that you focus on in your report. And that worried me slightly, particularly hot on the back of International Women's Day. More than two-thirds of companies say, yes, we are thinking about diversity and inclusion. It's part of our strategic objectives. But then you ask them, are you actually working on it? And then it was only a quarter, which means like 3 out of 4 are not working on diversity and inclusion. And to bring it back to your sample, of those 100 or so CEOs, how many were women?
Less than 20%.
Okay.
Closer to 10%. And I think that's representative of the landscape at the moment. But we have seen growth. We have seen the needle move slightly. The UAE, globally, 30% of boards and executives are women. In the UAE, only 40% of the organizations would have that ratio. But it has improved. It has grown. And 80% of businesses in the UAE particularly have females in the C-suite and board level.
Let's leave the report aside for 1 second and let's just talk about your business. You're Cooper Fitch, you're a recruitment firm. You tend to focus on the high-end jobs, C-suite and maybe one level below that. But you're not a mass recruiter, it's that level. In terms of the phone ringing or actually appointments being made in 2024, what are we? The 11th of March now. So we've had almost the first quarter. What are you seeing in terms of women being actively recruited to senior positions at the moment?
I would say half the mandates we receive, there is a direction that we want to see females in the process, in our research and our submissions and our reports. That is high. That is on the agenda.
So you
we see that we see that, and it's happening and it's growing.
Clients are saying to you effectively, no, all male shortlists.
Effectively. They want to see a mixture. They want to see a variety. They want to see talent. They want to open the doors to the best talent globally and locally that fit the criteria. The number one thing is to fit the position and the mandate.
Okay, so that's real progress, which is good to hear, Jack. But in terms of actual appointments and contracts that you and probably other firms like you, you're probably fairly typical of the industry, are actually signing, what percentage so far in 2024 would you say are women?
At that level, yeah. In terms of the C-suite and above, I'd say 15 to 20%.
15 to 20%. Brandy, you were on quite a lot of panel discussions last week, weren't you, regarding International Women's Day? A lot of companies and governments, you were with one UAE government minister as well talking about these things. When you hear that number of 15 to 20% of actual C-suite positions handed out so far in 2024 in this region are women, what do you make of that? Is that glass half full or half empty?
It is. I mean, I'm not a quota fan. It's not what we want to be, but it's absolutely in line if we look at what we see coming in here on the Business Breakfast. And we've taken unofficial numbers before, literally just, you know, marks on the back of an envelope to see what percentage. And our guests are all MD, GM, C-suite. You know, it's the boss. We talk to the boss. It does tend to be about that split male-female. Probably the most worrying thing is I first did those back-of-the-envelope numbers when Malcolm Taylor was alive. And I don't think they've changed.
They haven't changed an awful lot. Well, let's look at the positive and say there is some progress. It's moving in the right direction, which is good news. Can we talk a little bit about bonuses at the moment? You
Absolutely.
Ask the bosses about their bonuses, and they are getting them. Revenue's growing, bonuses are growing. The sweet spot, it seems, is between 4 to 9 months of salary. Tell us more.
Yeah, for short-term bonuses, annual bonuses, 6 to 7 months would be spot on in terms of what CEOs are earning. Over 50% would be in that range. Very similar to last year. That's quite common. That's not anything out of the norm.
What about more long-term incentive packages rather than just, okay, 2023 was a good year. There's, you know, 6 months bonus is nice. But, you know, for a business leader, for the Tim Cooks of this world, you're expecting share options that can propel you into the Forbes list.
Of
Are
course.
We seeing any of that?
Well, we're seeing a higher range of percentage of organizations start to implement long-term incentive plans, which is generally 3 to 5 years, which are made up of share stocks, options, even cash bonuses. Globally, publicly listed companies would have nearly 100% of their CEOs on such plans, and private organizations would have over 70%. In the region, it's only at approximately 50%. So there is work to be done there. But again, the dial has moved in that particular case where that is becoming more common. And that way, boards can manage annual fixed compensation and annual bonuses and really have CEOs and the leadership locked in to drive change and achieve the results that they're hired for.
And companies will pay up for that.
Absolutely, they will.
Last question, the springboard to the corner office, 30 seconds left. It's not being the CFO. Who's going to get the chief executive's job?
It definitely has changed in the last few years. 30% of CEOs interviewed believe the next successor will be the chief commercial officer. Very similar to last year. And that's very indicative of the market in the region. We've seen consistent revenue growth, optimistic performance, strong performance, product expansion, market expansion, and that's highly
driven. Is Chief Commercial Officer a fancy title for Head of Sales and Marketing?
More than that. They play a significantly more strategic role, quite often the second or the 2IC, and more operationally involved as well.
Going to have to leave it there, Jack. Fascinating insights. Appreciate your time. Jack Cavers there from Cooper Fitch. Their CEO report is out. If you want to get a copy of it, Google it, because they're giving it away for free.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast. You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.